Today on Vox Talks, how much of COVID-19's death toll is explained by a country's medical infrastructure? Welcome to Vox Talks from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. How many hospital beds are enough? In northern Italy, we know that when the number of cases of COVID-19 overwhelmed hospitals, the mortality rate spiked. But how strong and how consistent is the global relationship between medical infrastructure and mortality? As we begin to ease lockdowns and brace for a possible second wave of infection, this is definitely not just an academic question. A new paper in our COVID economics series investigates which factors, including medical infrastructure, have been driving the COVID-19 mortality rate, and there's a clear message to politicians in it. The author's Nathan Sussman of the Graduate Institute in Geneva. He's also a CEPR research fellow. Nathan, welcome back to Vox Talks.
Hello, Tim. Happy to be back with you.
You investigated whether medical infrastructure reduces the ratio of deaths per case in each country. But how do you measure the quality of infrastructure?
The data that I used was the number of beds per 1,000, per 10,000 people. Actually, that's measured in the 10,000 units. This is a number which is produced by the OECD, WHO, the World Bank, and it's very consistent. I would have liked to use more data about infrastructure, like the number of physicians in each hospital, the ICU units, ventilators, and so forth. But this data is not available for a large set of countries. It's only available for a small set of countries, not enough to do this cross-country analysis. So I use the number of beds.
There are so many confounding factors that can influence mortality, aren't there? Can you be sure that you're controlling for them all?
Oh, of course, I can't be sure that I control for everything. There are so many confounding factors in this, and I try to control for as many as I can. And to some extent, some guide for this is the percentage of the variance in deaths per capita that I can explain using my variables. It's not 100%, but it's quite high. I probably missed some variables. But the important thing I wanted to do in this specification is to actually use variables that are exogenous to COVID, or things that are not caused by the COVID-19, but actually what we may think about as in the medical literature as pre-existing conditions. The important thing for me was that to use variables that are not confounded in the sense that they're not affected by the response to COVID, and they're actually pre-existing conditions. I'm an economist, I'm not a medical researcher, I'm not a doctor. So obviously I'm looking at economic or macro variables rather than the specific medical variables that a medical researcher might look at. But I follow a similar strategy because medical researchers, what they do is they look at individual cases, individual patients, and see whether a certain treatment succeeded or not, given some pre-existing conditions. And what I'm doing is something on the macro level, not on individual patient level, but on a country level. And that's using similar methodology of saying, we have these pre-existing conditions and let's see how many patients survive.
How many countries did you manage to get data for? Are you confident that all of that data is really measuring the same thing?
So my baseline regression has data from 94 countries, and my more narrow specifications use 66 countries. There are some data issues whenever you're using such a large number of countries, especially countries that have known data issues. Mm. The important thing for me was that I used a consistent source for the data. So all the data comes from the same organization. So most of the data comes from the World Bank and the World Health Organization. So I trust that they do whatever they can to get the best data possible. I know that there are some objections and some reservations about the World Health Organization data, but this is the best I can do.
The simplest specification in your estimation that explains, I think, about 60% of deaths doesn't include medical infrastructure. So what does it include?
So the basic specification includes some basic controls. The first one is geographical controls. So I use the country's longitude and latitude. So that mainly controls for weather. We know that the virus probably strikes with varying intensities depending on weather conditions. And so we don't have the same, obviously the same seasonality everywhere around the globe. The other thing is also that immune systems are probably affected by weather conditions too. So in the winter, usually our immune systems are under more stress than in the summer. So I want you to control for these things. Again, these are very basic geographical fixed effects, as we call them. The basic classification controls for that. I controlled for deaths from the common flu. I think that there's a lot of misconception when we look at death rates from different countries that stems from the fact that we don't control for these, what we can say, the normal death rate from flu in those countries. Let me take an example. If we look at the death rates in Switzerland, where I'm based, and compare it, say, with Austria, then people would say, look, the death rate in Switzerland is very high relative to Austria. So the Austrian government must have done something right, better than the Swiss in terms of containment. But the normal death rate from flu in Switzerland is 6 times higher than Austria. Yesterday, the total death toll in Austria from COVID-19 was 643 cases. It was 1,915 in Switzerland, 3 times higher than Austria. Both countries have similar populations. So you tell me who was more successful in reducing deaths. Deaths from seasonal flu are not the whole story. Another variable that control in the basic classification is the demographics. We know that, unfortunately, this virus is more deadly for people that are above the age of 80. So once you control for the percent of population which is above the age of 80, you can explain quite a large variation in death rates. So these are the things I control for in the basic classification. And as you mentioned, they explain already about 60% of the variation in death rates.
So let's look at that other 40% as you build up the number of factors that are influencing this death rate. What else did you put in from the non-medical side?
So I tried to put in all kinds of other covariates. This is research in progress in some sense because we haven't seen the full extent of the deaths from COVID-19. You have to take whatever I'm saying with a grain of salt. I did try to control for additional economic variables. So I put in GDP per capita, the income per capita in the country, whether a country is more open for trade, whether it's more urban. These are things that might affect the rate of contagion from the disease, not the death from the disease, but rate of contagion from the disease. So we think that people that interact economically more frequently might have higher propensity to catch the disease. So for instance, if you go for New York, it's a very intense economic environment. It's a very open economic environment. It's highly urbanized, and therefore we might think that the infection rates there are higher. So I use these economic factors for the propensity to catch the disease, the contagion part of it. Another set of variables that I looked at, which is interesting in some sense, was institutional factors. In the press, there was a lot of mention about the fact that countries that are authoritarian, that are doing a better job in containment than countries that are more liberal, more open and democratic. So I use political science indices that measure the country's level of democracy, how open it is to dissent, and variables that look at government effectiveness and the quality of regulation, the observance of the rule of law, altogether 6 institutional variables. And what I found was that countries that score very high on democratic openness and the rule of law have higher death rates than other countries. Mm. And countries that score higher on indices of government effectiveness and regulatory quality have fewer deaths.
Yeah.
Of course, there's no real trade-off between open democracy and effective government, as some of these authoritarian leaders would like to claim. I think one can improve on government effectiveness without infringing on the rule of law. We know that some governments, and for example, the UK government, reacted too slowly. I don't think there would have been any penalty in the democracy indices for an earlier reaction. In that sense, again, it has become fashionable to claim, for instance, the success of the Singapore government for containing the disease compared to other countries. Some commentators mentioned the fact that this is sort of an authoritarian government and it has some advantage over more liberal governments in terms of containment. Again, going back to my example for Switzerland, so when you look at these initial pre-existing conditions, then Switzerland has about 150 times more deaths per capita from the regular flu than Singapore. So when you look at the 23 people who died total in Singapore from COVID relative to the Swiss 1900, then you have to factor in all these pre-existing conditions the fact that in Switzerland, in general, people die more from the flu. The fact that Switzerland has an aging population, which is, and Singapore's population is younger. So once you control for all these things, then some of these claims are muted.
Then finally, when we're talking about our pre-existing conditions, you add in the variable about hospital beds. What real world differences in mortality does that explain?
The main point that I wanted to make in this paper was to look at mortality rates. And all the other factors that we talked about so far are more broadly related to the contagion, the pre-existing conditions that make the disease more likely in one country than another, and deaths more likely in one country than another. And so my focus was on actual mortality and not the contagion. I think there's a lot of discussion about the case fatality ratios. That's how many people died relative to the people who are diagnosed. But we know that there are a lot of biases in the way we measure the diagnosed people. Different countries have different testing procedures. There's a lot of problems in the false negatives, false positives in the tests. Whereas when you measure deaths, again, there could be some errors in the way that the cause of death is not correctly specified, but at least we're measuring something that is observable rather than something which is unobservable. Mm. So the focus indeed was mortality scaled by population size. Then I introduced the hospital capacity as measured by the number of beds. And what I found is that in addition to all these pre-existing conditions, the number of hospital beds contributes about 8 or 10% to my explanation of the death rates.
That 8 or 10% is quite high, isn't it? Does this suggest any counterfactuals that if one country had the medical infrastructure of another country, then its death rate would have fallen?
One has to take these things with a grain of salt because we haven't seen the full extent of the deaths from COVID yet. But one such exercise that I did in the paper, which should be taken with a grain of salt again, is to deploy the number of hospital beds in Japan, in Italy. So holding everything else constant, using all the Italian pre-existing conditions like the demography, the geographic location, the normal deaths from flu, and deploying the number of beds per capita in Japan, in Italy, in Lombardy, which had the highest death rates. At the time I ran the regression, which was a couple of weeks ago, then thousands of lives could have been saved. That's very, very significant in the case of Italy or Spain. If they had the same medical capacity as Japan, according to the regression coefficients, thousands of lives could have been saved. By the way, Japan, which is the country in my data set has the highest number of beds per capita, also has a very high normal death rate from flu, a higher share of people above the age of 80 than Italy, and had fewer deaths. The regression and also common sense would tell you that hospital capacity goes a long way in explaining these differences in death rates. It's quite a significant contribution. It's not just the beds. I like to remind the audience, I'm looking at beds because it's the only thing I can count. But hospitals also have labs, testing facilities, ICU units, ventilators. So it's a proxy for all this other medical infrastructure that is very useful in fighting COVID.
Does your estimation suggest that the returns to this medical infrastructure are linear, or are there increasing returns or decreasing returns?
So in my estimation, I actually found that there are increasing returns. So actually, the more beds you have, the more effective it is. And that's given the current state of hospital beds in the world. So we don't have a country with too many beds. I don't think there is a country with too many.
Certainly not at the moment, yes.
Not at the moment. So the range we're looking at, within that range, there are actually scale effects. In the regression, I use the number of beds squared, not just the number of beds. So it actually has a power effect, not just a linear effect. And again, it might be related to the fact that the beds are also a proxy for other components of the medical infrastructure. And that's why squaring them probably measures all these other externalities that big hospitals have.
So, of course, Nathan, this is a cross-section you've taken across many countries. But at the moment, everyone's thinking, what do we do next? Can we extrapolate from what you found to say that if countries invest more in their medical infrastructure now, then it will reduce mortality?
Definitely. I think that while the virus can spread between countries and people can be affected by what's happening in a neighboring country, if you have more beds in your country, the regression results at least suggest that you're very likely to reduce the number of deaths. And again, it's for those countries that face a higher pre-existing risk, and therefore they should take more precautions, regardless of what their neighbors are doing. So if you're a country and your neighbors are not taking precautions, the same way that individuals should take precautions, regardless of whether the neighbors are taking precautions. Obviously, if your neighbors are not taking precautions, you have to take even more precautions. Countries that have better medical infrastructure can save more lives given their pre-existing conditions.
We often ask the guests on Vox Talks if they were policymaker for the day and they could affect some policy, what would it be? So I'm going to put you in that position now, Nathan. I've got a fairly good idea what you're going to say.
Yeah, I think it's quite straightforward, but I think there's quite a simple, straightforward policy recommendation is that countries that face higher risks, they have aging populations, they have higher normal death rate from the flu, they should take stock and make sure that they have enough medical capacity. Now, what they have to do is simply look at the distribution of beds by country. And if you're a country that has a high risk and you're on the lower tail of the distribution, you should ask yourself, is this enough? And you should invest more. Again, some countries are well equipped and some countries have very low probability of deaths. But if you're a country like Italy, the UK, Spain, the countries with very high death rates, you should ask yourself, do you have enough medical capacity? And I think that the answer in this case is that you don't. And you should invest more in medical capacity, beds, testing, and all these other things. Two final comments related to that. So I think medical capacity is not just crucial in saving lives, but it also allows policymakers to manage a crisis without creating panic, without excess economic and institutional burdens, such as very stringent curfews, sending military to enforce them. So once you have the medical capacity, I think as a policymaker, you can make better choices, better policy choices than when you're constrained. So this might not be directly related to death rates. Nevertheless, it influences and affects in a significant way the way the crisis is unfolding, and especially the economic and some of, as I said, these institutional burdens that we saw in some very advanced democracies that are sending military to enforce curfews. These are things that one should not take lightly. Finally, I must say that investing in beds and medical capacity is very important and something which is very easy to implement and can reduce your death rates, but it's not the only recommended policy response to COVID-19, obviously. So mass testing, social distancing are crucial in reducing contagion. So I'm not saying that investing in medical capacity is the only solution, but it is something that is easy to implement and can reduce and save a lot of lives.
Nathan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tim.
The numbers are evolving all the time on this one. Are you going to keep updating your work here?
So I intend to redo the entire analysis once the dust has settled, once we see it unfold throughout the world, because currently my data on death rates is highly biased towards the countries that were affected initially. Now that we know that the disease has spread to Latin America, to Africa, I'd be interested to see whether my conclusions would still hold. I'm pretty sure they would. I think that maybe some of the other covariates I used might become less significant because they're highly biased towards advanced economies, but having more medical infrastructure, I think, would survive the expansion of the data set.
Well, we'll be looking out for that. But for now, the paper, it's called Time for Beds, Hospital Capacity and Mortality from COVID-19. And of course, author Nathan Sussman, and it is published in COVID Economics. The issue is, let me just check, issue 11. There are so many issues of COVID Economics already. If you thought, I'd like to hear more from this Nathan Sussman, then listen to our previous Vox Talk, and it's called A New Story of London's Economic Development, a very different subject, and that was recorded in October 2019. This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. We bring you the most innovative economic research every week. So subscribe to Vox Talks and you'll never miss an episode. And remember, you can find 10 years of Vox Talks at voxeu.org/vox-talks.